forever hand in hand. Our children,
how they laugh. She has never laughed like this.
Every waking moment, bliss. Our children,
see them running down the beach. Children run so fast
toward the future
from the past.
How they dance, unembarrassed and alone, hearing music of their own. Our children,
one so fair
and the other lithe and dark,
solemn joy and sudden spark.
Hi, everybody. I'm Susanna Mars from Adventures in Artslandia, and I'm in today for Dimay Roberts. That was Maren Mazie and Peter Friedman singing Our Children from Ragtime by Stephen Flaherty and Lynn Ahrens with a book by the great Terrence McNally. That was an epic that included the story of a father and daughter emigrating from Russia who were searching for and making family, and you'll see why I chose that blurb probably in this interview. Today I'm talking to playwright Andrea Stolowitz, whose play Berlin Diary will be produced by Hand to Mouth Theater in association with Coho Theater. And Andrea has had a very fruitful relationship with Hand to Mouth, beginning with her work on Pep Talk, then Time, A Fair Hustler, and now this production of Berlin Diary. She's also a recipient of Artist Repertory Theater's $25,000 new play commission and premiered Ithaca there in 2013, and it won the 2015 Oregon Book Award for Drama. She's also a fellow artist, resident artist at Artist Rep, and has been recently named the first LeCroot Playwright in Residence, which offers her an annual salary and funds to enhance and promote the development of her scripts and supports her professional development. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you.
I just have to say, after reading more about what you're doing right now, I'm just wowed by what you're creating for your own life in terms of your creative work. It's just remarkable. Congratulations for everything you've got going on.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And I'm curious, you know, in light of the future potential cuts in arts funding, the residency that you've received has restored some of my confidence in individual funders really stepping up to the plate. And Ronnie LeCroot, being the person in this case, she's moving towards supporting the arts in very innovative ways. How did the residency come into being?
Yeah, so Ronnie and I have known each other for a while, and she's enjoyed my work. And ART and I had applied for a Mellon Playwright in Residence grant about 2 years ago, which we didn't get. And I've been adjuncting and teaching a lot. And then in October, I had a production of Berlin Diary, which is now playing here at Coho Theater in Berlin. And I went there and I just did some thinking about my artistic life. And I thought, it's just amazing. I've had this project that went from a research grant all the way to a production in Berlin, and it's going to be later produced in Portland. And I have work being done all over, and I can't support myself as an artist. And I spend a lot of time teaching, and it's very stressful. And I'm 45 years old and I don't have any retirement, and things like that are really beginning to, you know, you kind of think about them. So I was in Berlin in October and I just thought, it can't go on like this. I've got to do something different. I have to get more out of teaching, and I have to be able to devote my time more to playwriting because I'm having all this great success. And so I kept thinking, I wished I had gotten this Mellon grant, which would have been a 3-year salary at ART. And then I recalled that when I was in graduate school, I had the good fortune of studying with Eduardo Machado and Charles Mee, so Chuck Mee, the playwright, both of them playwrights. And both of them had mentioned that they had arts patrons who were funding them, who had provided them and were providing them with a salary. And that kind of came into my mind. And I thought, well, let me look up more about this and how they got it. And I knew them personally, and I found 2007 Financial Times article about arts patrons, and in it, Chuck Mee is quoted as saying, "I went to my patron and I said, every play I write is putting me that much farther behind in feeding my family." And I thought, gee, that's my problem too. I have two kids. You know, I'm just trying to make a living here. And then my second thought was, wow, as a woman, I would never utter those words in a million years, because I've been schooled to not mention my family. Because if you do, then if I said, oh, I can't feed my family because I'm a playwright, most people would say, so don't be a playwright, you're a mother. And I found it really empowering that, you know, some guy in 2007 was able to say that to his patron and it worked. And I thought, well, I'm going to ask, I'm going to talk to Ronnie and I'm going to see if, you know, modeled on the Mellon Foundation Playwrights in Residence Grant and several others that have popped up around the country. It's a very sort of popular thing right now for playwrights for the exact reason that I've articulated. We've been working in this business for 20 years and we don't have any financial security to show for it. So I talked to Ronnie about it and explained what I wanted to do and where I wanted to do it and how, and she said yes.
Well, it's very inspirational. I think it can really serve a lot of artists in asking for what you want and also in believing that art for art's sake is valuable in our culture and we need it.
Yeah, thankfully there are funders like Ronnie who believe that with their heart and with their pocketbook.
Right. And we got to keep searching them out and hopefully they'll search us out.
Yeah.
So your latest play, Berlin Diary, was presented at the English Theater in Berlin International Performing Arts Center in October of 2016 and just opened at Hand to Mouth last weekend.
Right, at Coho.
At Coho, in association with Coho. And it's going to run here through April 30th. And there's going to be more information, including tickets, on the website cohoproductions.org. So now to dig into Berlin Diary, which is really fascinating. It's inspired by your own research into your own family history after receiving your great-grandfather's diary from the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Archive. That just gave me the chills when I read it. It was so exciting. And I wondered, how did you first receive it?
Oh, well, it's not quite as exciting and as scintillating as it might sound. I first got it, as you'll see in the play, in 2006 when my mother had the archivist from the Holocaust Museum send me a copy after she donated the diary to the museum. And it's a really, really hard to read document. It's half in English and half in German with really, really tiny, 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 minuscule script. And it's kind of was like this sort of treasured family heirloom. And my mom donated it to the museum after saying to me for several years, well, who's going to take it when I'm dead? And I thought, please not me. I'm not taking it when you're dead. Please donate it somewhere. And she donated it to the museum. And then the museum sent me high quality colored copies. And I sort of opened the stack of high quality colored copies. And I thought, oh, good Lord. And I closed it. And then I put it up on a shelf high above my desk for eight more years. So that's how I first got it.
I love that you said that because I'm just personally working on something and it just gives me heart to see someone who I admire as a creative artist. That happens.
Well, I hadn't planned to write a play around it then. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I just put the document away because I wasn't really interested in dealing with the document at that time. But as soon as in 2013, when I realized my husband's from East Germany, my kids are dual citizens. Their parents live in so my kids' grandparents live in Berlin. So when my husband was on sabbatical from Reed College, where he teaches, which is why we're in Oregon and why we live here, then I realized we'd be in Germany for the year. And I thought, well, what project do I want to work on? And that's when I pulled the diary back out. And I kind of realized that that was the really the right time for me to be creating art out of the project. So it wasn't like I had found it in 2006 and I didn't know how to make art out of it. It was just I didn't care.
Right. It's just timing.
Yeah.
All confluence of events.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm curious then, since so much of it was written in German, do you speak German?
Oh, yeah. I lived in Berlin from 1995 to 1997.
Oh, right. So you could translate it yourself.
Yeah.
Oh, fascinating. That must have been really interesting.
Yeah. And then as he gets better, the diary is written from 1939 to 1948. And as he lives longer in the United States, he switches almost entirely to English because he realizes that he's writing it for his grandchildren. And he realizes that they'll, of course, be native English speakers. So in the beginning, his English isn't so good and he tries as hard as he can. And then he sort of switches to English. But he does write a lot of poetry and birthday greetings to people. And they're all in the book. And a lot of those are in German. And that became kind of critical to translate because I had to figure out who he was talking to so I could figure out who he knew so I could figure out where they were.
So the characters of the play, since I haven't seen it yet, I'm assuming that your grandfather is a character in the play. Is that right?
Sort of. You know, I'm a character. He's a character. There are about 13 other characters. And it's a pretty non-traditional form of storytelling in terms of there are two actors that are playing everybody, but they don't entirely only play one of the characters. So there's two actors who both play me sometimes at the same time.
And that's Aaron Letty and Damon Cupper, both of whom are wonderful actors.
Amazing, yeah.
Yeah. That's great. I'm talking to Andrea Stolowitz, author of Berlin Diary, which has just opened at Coho Theater, associated with Hand to Mouth Theater. And it's going to run through April 30th, and you can find tickets and information at cohoproductions.org. So being that we're both resident artists at Artist Rep, I've watched you from afar journey into this play. And going to Berlin required a big move for you and your family. And you've spoken earlier about your two children. How'd you navigate the personal aspects of this trip with your work life?
Oh, well, I just got a grant to write a play in Berlin. So.
Well, I mean, but I mean, I know as a mom, you have children. They went to school.
They came with me.
Right. And
they went to school in Berlin.
Right. And you just did, you just literally moved your life to Berlin.
The cats didn't come. We were sad about that. Yeah, we rented out our house in Portland to some medical students, and they seemed happy to live in our house, and, you know, that was good. And then they took care of our cats, which was also good. And we moved to Berlin, and we rented an apartment, and the kids went to school, and I researched, and I used the grant that I got to research the play. And my husband did work at the Technical University in Berlin. He's a physicist, so we did that. And, but I had lived there, as I said, from 95 to 97, so... It wasn't a big deal. For the kids, it was a little bit more overwhelming. They had to, of course, do all their schoolwork in German, but they speak German pretty well. And so not as native speakers would do in third and sixth grade, but they did fine. They made friends and, you know, they'll probably live through the experience. Well, they did live through the experience and they'll probably psychologically recover at some point.
Or I bet, to my mind, it would just be completely enriching, but, you know.
That's the adult perspective.
Yes, you're right. So, you know, Passover was just recent.
Yeah.
And our family Seder really spoke a lot about the current refugee crisis. And I really, in particular, about the responsibility of the Jewish people to stand up for people who are seeking asylum because of our experience in that regard. So I wondered, how does your Judaism connect you to the plight of the refugee today?
Yeah, I would say it's sort of an interesting question. You know, what is it to be a Jewish artist? What are the sort of the themes that we come back to? And for me, in my particular experience, both with the Judaism and as a Jewish artist, I do come back often to the refugee experience, to the experience of fleeing, to the fear of death, you know, these sorts of things. So I connect very personally right now to the refugee crisis. And if, you know, and remember that I was living in Berlin from 2014 to 15, which was the height of the refugee crisis. So a million people were arriving in Germany. And that's really different, actually, than the United States, where actually the refugee crisis feels kind of abstract.
Mm-hmm.
So in Berlin, there are people all from Syria that you run into all the time. There are tons and tons and tons of refugees. It's all over. And so you can't just sort of, it's a very complicated issue. And it's, I don't know, I think it's sort of abstract here in the United States because we are not really participating in, as a government, in aiding these refugees, particularly from Syria,
right,
where 4.5 million of them are sitting now in Turkey.
Right. And the political situation in Turkey now is shifting in a way that is dramatically going to...
And the reason 4.5 million Syrians are in Turkey is because that's where the European Union would prefer to have them. And so there's a lot of work to be done that I really do relate to and feel really compelled by.
Yeah. What was it like when you were there recently in terms of the refugees? Similar to how it
was? 2015 was really like the height of it, and now it's gotten much more organized.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in 2015, there were so many people that came across the Mediterranean. They came across through Greece and that were arriving in Germany, and so many borders had been closed to them. And these were people who were fleeing for their lives and had, you know, gone in little tiny rafts across the Mediterranean, sometimes without life jackets. So at that point, it was hugely welcoming because everybody had this sense of goodwill, and it was also very chaotic. And now it is less welcoming because it's complicated to have a million new refugees come in a period of 8 months to your country. So it's a little less welcoming, but a little bit more organized. And I think in the end, it'll serve the refugees better to have a more organized way of getting asylum.
So in light of the fact that really, as you said, the feeling of how refugees, the whole refugee crisis in the United States is rather abstract, I've been thinking about how can we encourage the world or our, you know, communities to think in the kinds of terms that will make space for the compassion for these people. It's complicated. And I know it's caught up in money, to my mind, at least. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, the news outlets would probably be the most compelling, you know, watch, you know, the news outlets that have videos of people trying to make it across the Mediterranean with their kids as the Italian Coast Guard zips in to rescue them. I mean, I don't think it gets more compelling than that. And I mean, we're not going to see those people on our shores because we are not offering them asylum. And so it feels very abstract to agitate for helping people that you don't even have an awareness of. So
the five films that were nominated for Best Short Subject Documentary Academy Awards this year are accessible on YouTube. I think most of them, and three of the five, are about that very subject, and they're extremely painful to watch. And I encourage us to all step into that suffering, because it really helps open up the door to realizing the realities that these people are facing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, did you see the one about the Greek captain?
Yes.
Yeah, that was intense.
Yes.
The
island of Lesbos, right?
Yeah. What was the title of? I can't remember the title of
it. I can't either.
But it was one of the short documentaries.
Yes.
And it's incredible. It was really, really moving. And so things like that, I think, that are really firsthand accounts. But I do feel we're a little bit separated from it here, because it's just not part of our day-to-day existence in the way that it is in Europe, where people can just show up.
Mm-hmm.
And here, you can't just show up, because you'd have to get on a plane.
Well, and we all know how getting on a plane is nowadays.
Exactly.
So I'm talking to Andrea Stolowitz, author of Berlin Diary, which just opened at Coho in association with Hand to Mouth Theater, which is going to run through April 30th. And more info, including tickets, at cohoproductions.org. I read that there's going to be a panel event at Coho on immigration and following a matinee of Berlin Diary on April 23rd, and it's going to assemble personal stories from around the globe about the challenges and rewards of genealogical searches, which I think is so fascinating, because this search for family is, on a small scale, an incredible personal story of yours and of so many other people, but then the large scale of our humanity searching for family. What are the challenges and rewards of your research about your own family, and how do you think that touches like our larger worldview?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think, I guess it's all, I'm a parent, and so I think about family as to the kind of family that I want to make for my children and the kind of understanding I want them to have about family. And so I think in order to do that, I had to go back and look at the history and who the people were and sort of the specific details of my own family in order to process that and then create the family that I want for my kids. And so I don't know if everybody's dynamic interest in genealogy is sort of personal like that, but I suspect it is. I suspect there's that sense of, if you can understand the past, you can convey a better present to your children. And I think that people who are trying to find out directly about their family. And mostly it's people that have been in situations where war has torn apart their family, or slavery, or some kind of really historical situation that has fragmented what would normally be a family structure. I think all of us who have had that in our lives feel kind of jealous of the families that are like, I can trace my family back to 1420 or 1810 or even, you know, I don't know, 1901. Because when you've been touched by historical events that have fragmented your family, you don't have that. Your family is broken. But other people have all their cousins and they know where they are. And that's not the case when you've been touched by historical events like slavery, like the Armenian Genocide, like the Holocaust, tons of others.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I'm from a family that's similarly broken. And I think it's been really interesting to think about my desire to find my ancestors, to find my genealogy. And then I'm also, as you're speaking, I'm thinking about when your family is broken, all of a sudden, I mean, as a kid, I was looking for family and not necessarily my relatives. I mean, I was looking for someone to behave like a family in my world. And I almost feel like that's a road into unifying our culture, our world, in that bottom line, all this suffering is the same. And really, we are one family in my thinking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that by having a broken family and not this solid, you know, I know my family from, you know, 1842. I mean, that's beautiful. But also, when your family breaks open, you realize that your family can be so much bigger than what that bloodline is.
Yes and no. I mean, I think fundamentally, yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean,
yeah.
Otherwise, people wouldn't be searching so heartily for their families. I mean, I think at the end of my search, I didn't come to, and now anyone can be in my family. I came to, I've looked at the past so that I can put it in perspective for my children. So I don't, I mean, I think yes, mm-hmm. like on a sort of global nice sense, everyone can be in each other's families, but we don't really look at it that way. And mm-hmm. biologically, we certainly don't. Right.
Right. Yeah, that's true. So your great-grandfather wrote his diary as a message to his grandchildren and beyond. So what questions do his actions raise about communicating with future generations in this age of the internet? Like, how are young people, keeping these bits of information?
Yeah,
or are
kind
they?
Of brilliant. I mean, I don't know. You know, I was just listening to something on NPR the other day, and I didn't get to hear the whole thing, but it was exactly detailing this. And then it's so amazing that Hand to Mouth is doing a whole presentation after, I think, the Sunday matinee on the 30th, no, on the
22nd,
the 23rd, mm-hmm. yeah, about the digital archiving and message to the future. It's super interesting. And I don't know how, I mean, we hardly write anything down anymore. And so it really, but maybe it'll shift. I think if I recall what I was listening to, they were basically saying this is very new, this technology, this digital technology, and we're in this kind of weird baby step of it. But that when we really are able to embrace digital technology and what it can do, we will be archiving and we will have these kind of messages. They'll just be different. And so I guess the theory was right now we're kind of in an imperfect or very, very baby stage of it. Somewhere between, you know, writing things down and keeping diaries to what will be the future of archiving digitally. And we don't know. Right now we're kind of in this vestigial weird place with it. But it is interesting that I'm reading this book from my great-grandfather, and I feel that I'm leaving no kind of record really for my great-grandchildren. I guess maybe my plays, that'll be nice. They'll be able to read my plays, so that's lucky, I guess.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting because it reminds me, you know, as artists, I feel like we're hoarders to some extent. You know, I mean, I look back at archived information and how you even sift through it to get what you need or want. It's kind of like how your trip to Berlin came through. It's this confluence of events. You think, oh, right, that book's on the shelf. I could do that. It's magic almost, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you can archive all you want, but how do you know how to use it?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just curious, in all you've learned through this process, what do you think is important for your children to know about how to live a happy life?
Well, I mean, I think, I guess, facing the things that are unpleasant, if you can, rather than avoiding them. But I mean, that's sort of easier to say when you're not psychologically damaged by the Holocaust or by fleeing. But yeah, I would just say that there's a benefit to shining the light in the unwanted and unlooked at parts of family that feel uncomfortable. So that maybe the uncomfortable thing is what brings you closer, maybe shining the light on the uncomfortableness of being in a family and all that entails is what being in a family is, and maybe embracing that.
Did your third and sixth graders notice refugees in Germany, and did you talk about that, or how did that appear to them?
You know, I think Berlin's such a huge city mm-hmm. with so many people that they didn't, I mean, you know, it's not like you notice refugees, they are in certain residences, you know, and I mean, so I don't think that they would, I mean, and Berlin is filled with people that are non-Germans, so mm-hmm. I don't think it would be like, did you notice mm-hmm. refugees in New York? It's
right.
Like, no, I
right.
was just in a big city with
so
lots of
different
people.
So they never had an experience that was that brought that to light.
No,
for them,
and it's just
a
big city.
What were their schoolmates like? All German?
Well, you mean, are they German citizens?
Yeah, they were in a public.
They're in a public school. Mm-hmm. So it was a German public school, mm-hmm. and some of the kids were from Turkey, and some of the kids were from Lebanon, and some of the kids were from Berlin, and I mean, I don't know the citizenship status of the ones from Turkey, mm-hmm. but they were, so I can't tell you whether they were Germans.
Oh, right. My question's not necessarily about that. It's just about that diversity piece coming back home and that's...
Well, Portland certainly felt very white mm-hmm. when we returned.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Interesting.
Yes.
So if you had your choice of their staying in Germany or being here in Portland, what would you choose?
Well, I like Portland. You know, I like the mountains. I like the gorge. I like how beautiful it is. I like riding my bike around. And Berlin is pretty flat, and it's hard to get out of the city. And you have to drive 8 hours to go skiing. And I don't know. I mean, I think in general, we go back every year. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to live here and have them be raised here and have the experience. I mean, they're citizens. They can go to university there if they want to. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming today. And I want to remind everybody that we're talking about the play Berlin Diary, which is playing at Coho Theater in association with Hand to Mouth Theater. And it's going to run through April 30th. And you can find tickets and more information at cohoproductions.org. And this was Andrea Stolowitz, the author of that play. And, you know, if you want to fund art, find someone to fund.
And that's right.
You can do that at any time. And thank you for listening to Stage and Studio. I want to thank Tave Fashe Drake for being an incredible technician. And also thanks to Demay Roberts for entrusting me with her amazing show. And thanks again, Demay, for everything you do for the arts community. You're incredible. Have a great day, everybody.
How they play, finding treasure in the sand. They're forever hand in hand, our children.
How they laugh. She has never laughed like this.
Every waking moment, bliss. Our children.
See them running down the beach. Children run so fast.
Toward the future.
From the past.
How they dance. Unembarrassed and alone. Hearing music of their own. Our children,
one so fair,
and the other lithe and dark,
solemn joy and sudden spark.
Our children.